Okay, another thing about Colonel Prouty, since, again, it is his information that is important here, is that Colonel Prouty not only held, one could say, almost a critical position in the events that we've been talking about, the U-2 and the Bay of Pigs and things of that nature, but Colonel Prouty's veracity, as far as I know, nobody has ever been able to take him down. Many people have wanted to because, of course, Colonel Prouty has put some thorns in some very highly placed sides. And nobody has ever been able to disprove any of Colonel Prouty's allegations as to these things going on.
Good point. Not only that, but Prouty has been sought out by both right-wing, far right-wing, and left-wing or left-of-center sources. So apparently his integrity and veracity transcends ideological boundaries. You'll see him quoted by far-right mercenary publications as well as by so-called radical elements, too. Now, before we get into this segment of tape here, basically, this is going to be from a Hard Rain broadcast from June 3rd of 1981, almost 2.5 years ago. First, Nip has a comment here.
Yeah, I want to mention a couple of things, and this is very important because a lot of people, again, we're talking about a period in history that quite a few of our listeners were not of sufficient age to have been following at the time in terms of news and things going on, and that furthermore, that since then has come almost entirely into the I would say under the auspices of people writing news and writing history, many of whom have chosen some rather lamentable shortcuts. A couple of very key things. The first is just, for instance, myself. I was just looking at a sociology textbook the other day, and they used the example of John F. Kennedy and his cabinet concocting the Bay of Pigs as being an example of group think, meaning inability of a group to make a correct decision because of a wish for unanimity or something of that nature. Anyway, as Colonel Prouty and other people have mentioned and have made clear in the past, this operation was planned long before John F. Kennedy was in office, long before it was even known that John F. Kennedy was elected to office. Okay, that's a critical point because people since have come to believe, because it's sort of just bandied around, that, well, of course, John F. Kennedy initiated the Bay of Pigs. Simply not true, but something, as I said, I just saw in an up-to-date sociology textbook. Another key point, and this, in fact, is, again, getting back to setting the stage into an understanding of what was going on in the United States at that time. As I mentioned, there was a what could be called a core of full-time civil service level intelligence operatives. In other words, people who had been in intelligence since perhaps World War II and would in fact devote their entire lives to clandestine intelligence. Now, not to tar them all with the same brush, but quite a few of these people have proven since to be just about devoid of human values. And I think that anybody who's watched, the Watergate hearings or the Church Commission hearings and things of this nature are quite aware of that. But now the key point, and the point I'm holding up this tape to make, is that the capture, if you will have it that way, of Cuba by Castro, in other words, the overthrowing by Castro of an extremely right-wing government, which even the U.S. supported in terms of the overthrow for a while, was when it was revealed that Castro was himself left of center, was a Marxist, was going to try and redistribute the wealth, et cetera, et cetera. And then later on, when he was rebuffed by the United States based on his political philosophies and they had to make contacts with Russia, this was a thorn in the side of America's intelligence establishment, such as it has never seen before or since. I mean, Cuba is still a driving obsession for many people in clandestine intelligence. This is one of the reasons that the Reagan administration came in talking about Cuba as soon as they got into office and the possibility that maybe we were going to start making things hot for Cuba again. The presence of a Marxist state 90 miles off the coast of Florida has been an obsession unequaled. And this is one of the main reasons that so many things having to do with clandestine intelligence, with renegade members of clandestine intelligence or pseudo-renegade members of clandestine intelligence, Watergate, assassinations, and a variety of other things often come back down to this Cuba lobby because it was a pivotal and a crucial point to the thinking of most American intelligence agents.
Now keep in mind the accurately stated antipathy of the United States towards Cuba, because the information that Prouty is going to be presenting here is going to be quite startling. To give you an idea of what you're going to be listening to here, because a lot of information is going to be run by you in a relatively short period of time, the most important thing about the about Prouty's presentation here is the fact that he maintains that it was the CIA itself, or an element thereof, specifically in the person of General Charles Cabell, who was deputy director of the CIA at the time, that it was the CIA itself which deliberately sabotaged its own covert operation in the Bay of Pigs, and as the title, the betrayal of JFK kept Fidel Castro in power, that basically that betrayal occurred by the CIA. Now, to tell you what you're going to be listening to, first of all, the first section here that Prouty is going to be talking about is going to deal with the fact that John F. Kennedy, when he was a presidential candidate, learned of what Prouty terms an insider's cabal to launch the Bay of Pigs operation. Now, this is important to note because just as we saw with the U-2 incident, the Bay of Pigs operation was undertaken by a group of the Cold War civil servants that Nip/Tuck talked about just a few minutes ago. It was undertaken on their own against President Eisenhower's specific directives, because he forestalled all action against Cuba until it could be better determined just what nature of fish Castro was. That then this insider's cabal, led by Richard Nixon, who was at the time vice president and in charge of the control group, in charge of all covert operations, basically, this insider's cabal went ahead on its own in direct contradiction of Eisenhower's wishes to plan the Bay of Pigs. Now, candidate John F. Kennedy penetrated this insider's cabal to a certain extent, learned of some of the impending plans for the invasion, and thereby ran afoul of this insider's cabal, including Richard Nixon, who we're going to talk about later, who is President Kennedy's 1960 opponent. He learned about this running afoul of that cabal even before he became president. Now, two terms that Prouty talks about here, which are absolutely essential for understanding the Bay of Pigs and understanding how the CIA deep-sixed its own operation, are the terms air cover and air support. Now, air support refers to action taken by warplanes against ground forces in support of one's own ground forces. Okay, air cover or air support is action taken by air forces against units on the ground on behalf or in support of one's own forces. Air cover refers to action by aircraft against opponent's aircraft. In other words, if you're staging a military operation and the enemy is coming at you with airplanes, you need aircraft of your own to provide air cover against the enemy's aircraft. Now, Kennedy has been faulted for not providing the Bay of Pigs invasion with air cover, without utilizing the Air Force itself to provide air cover for the Bay of Pigs operation. There were numerous appeals for air cover, which Kennedy quite correctly or quite accurately did turn down. Now, what Prouty points out and what isn't mentioned is that the original plan for the Bay of Pigs invasion would not have needed air cover. The CIA's air wing had put together a group of World War II B-26 bombers, which were outfitted with a very impressive array of machine guns specifically for use against ground targets. And U.S. espionage and reconnaissance had located all of Castro's Air Force, which was tiny. Now, the core of Castro's Air Force were three T-33 jet trainers of American manufacture, each of which were armed with some 50 caliber machine guns. Now, these planes, if they got into the air, would have been capable of trashing the B-26 propeller-driven planes that the CIA had provided for air support for the invasion. Now, because of this, a provision had been made for a preemptive strike by the CIA's B-26s on the T-33 jets, which had been located by U.S. reconnaissance. Now, it was General Charles Cabell, who, according to Prouty, was one of the major figures, along with Prouty himself, in the chain of command for Bay of Pigs, who deliberately scotched the order for the B-26s to attack the T-33s, thereby eliminating Castro's Air Force, and thereby eliminating the need for air cover. Okay, so this is the importance of the difference between air cover and air support. Had the CIA or an element thereof not deliberately deep-sixed its own operation, there would have been no need for air cover. So this is absolutely essential to keep in mind as you listen to Prouty's argument. And then keep in mind that as Air Force focal point officer, he was directly and highly placed in the chain of command, as we're going to see. So without further ado, here is the article from Gallery by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty dealing with how the CIA deep-sixed the Bay of Pigs.
And you are listening.
Under Eisenhower, there never was a plan to invade Cuba. There may have been hope for it on the part of the Cubans, but the president had not sanctioned such an act. As a matter of fact, we had explicit orders not to become involved in any operation which in any way would carry over from the Eisenhower administration into the next administration, either Nixon or Kennedy. These orders were explicit and understood by all of us in the clandestine game during the crucial midsummer of 1960. Then, Senator Kennedy began to make his moves. JFK aimed for the presidency, and he was unique. He not only campaigned long and hard to weld together a knowledgeable, hard-hitting team, he also carried that team over into his administration. They began to dig into the clandestine dung heap. The magnetic Cuban speaker in Detroit, Manuel Artime, was the ace in the CIA's anti-Castro deck, but JFK got to him. On the very same day, Artime and his other Cuban inner circle exiles were escorted into the Pentagon's super-secret Office of Special Operations, Office of the Secretary of Defense. On that very same day, those same Cubans were spirited away from the CIA into the office of Senator Jack Kennedy. JFK won up the CIA and the Pentagon and Nixon on Cuban affairs even before that crucial TV debate with Nixon. I'd like to interrupt here to point out something I neglected to mention in the introduction. Nixon was the head of the National Security Council group in charge of covert operations, which is how he came to be involved with what Prouty terms the insider's cabal. Continuing here with Prouty's narrative, Kennedy didn't get all of the inside data, but he kept Nixon and the CIA cabal on their toes. By October of 1960, this insider's cabal decided it was time to make several moves. If Nixon won the election, they would be well on their way with several major clandestine operations in full swing. If Kennedy won, the cabal might have enough momentum to overpower any deflecting moves he might make. And if the secret operations failed, Kennedy would be blamed because no one knew they were initiated before he became president. The word went out to step up the Cuban exile training in Florida, Louisiana, Panama, and Guatemala. Next, Prouty goes on to describe the tactical plan for the Bay of Pigs operation. As I mentioned before, the CIA's Air Division had provided for some propeller-driven B-26s to fly in support of the Cuban Exile Brigade, and that basically these were equipped with special armament to make them particularly potent against ground targets, and that the operation plan called for these planes to destroy all of Castro's Air Force, and especially Castro's U.S.-built T-33 jet trainers, which, though lightly armed, were so much more maneuverable than the propeller-driven B-26s the CIA brigade had, that basically the B-26s would have been no match for these T-33s. Now, as I said, the original plans were to knock out these T-33s, and Prouty goes on to describe the tactical situation as follows. Castro had a half-dozen B-26 aircraft, which, unlike the CIA B-26s, had no machine guns. They were light bombers. He had a few old British combat fighters called Sea Furies, and he had three T-33 jets. The T-33s each had two 50-caliber machine guns. That was not much firepower, but with their high speed, those jets had a huge advantage over the CIA B-26s, and their 50-caliber guns were lethal. The Air Division plan called for the destruction of Castro's combat aircraft on the ground before the brigade hit the beach. This was an absolute must. Everyone knew that. Kennedy knew that, Alan Dulles knew that, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Lyman L. Lemnitzer knew that, and all the key CIA mission commanders knew that. The principal CIA combat commander was a U.S. Marine Corps colonel, and he knew that. If Castro's aircraft were destroyed first, there would be no need for air cover. The B-26s would be air support. On the Saturday before the Monday of the invasion, the Exile Brigade's B-26s had taken off to destroy the Cuban Air Force planes on the ground. They totaled the B-26s and the Sea Furies, but they did not find the T-33s. A U-2 was sent up to locate them. It found them parked wingtip to wingtip near Santiago, Cuba. They would easily be destroyed at sunrise on Monday. In the dark of that moonless night, the CIA mission commander in Nicaragua rode his bicycle toward those four B-26s. He signaled them to fire up their engines and stand by. Then he waited for the release from Washington, which would tell him all was going according to plan, to send the bombers on their way. The commander knew the mission depended upon the success of this operation. He was ready, and the crack Cuban crews were raring to go. Their orders were to strike that small base where the T-33s were parked, coming in at sunrise with the sun at their tails and flying low to avoid possible radar and ground fire. Still later, Prouty goes on to say, only three small jets parked on an airfield near Santiago stood between success and failure. General C.P. Cabell, C-A-B-E-L-L, Dulles' CIA deputy who was running the operation in Dulles' absence, knew that as he monitored events at the command center in Washington. The engines on those four bombers at Puerto Cabezas idled slowly as the minutes grew to hours. If they were to strike at dawn, they had to leave as scheduled. It was a long way to Santiago across the Caribbean. The CIA Operations Control Officer got on his bicycle again and pedaled back to the communications tent to see if the orders releasing the planes had come. The Cubans in the B-26s were angry and impatient. The thought crossed the agent's mind they might mutiny and go anyhow. The CIA agent wished they would go, but there were no orders from Washington. The CIA mission commander was an old friend of mine. We had been through many clandestine operations together, and we had complete confidence in each other. At about 2 a.m. Washington time on April 17th, my home telephone rang. The mission commander was calling from Nicaragua. He explained what was happening. He held the phone up, and I could hear the roaring B-26 engines. He emphasized the crucial timing for that essential flight. They had to go. He asked me to call the CIA command center and to talk to them about getting the release out immediately. The fate of the operation hung on that thin thread, and the thread broke. Well, Prouty next goes on to describe a number of bogus versions of the history of the Bay of Pigs, all of which, as I said, followed the sort of traditional line that Kennedy was responsible for the failure, for the operation's failure, because he neglected or deliberately withheld air cover. And, of course, as we have seen and will delve into in greater detail, that failure was due to C.P. Cabell's failure to send off the airstrike to neutralize Castro's T-33s. Anyway, Prouty goes on to describe the bogus versions of the Bay of Pigs and what really happened as follows. There have been many versions of the Bay of Pigs. All have been written by people who were not involved. Robert D. Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W, wrote a fantastic account in a book called Betrayal. His account is incorrect. Reporters have written about the Bay of Pigs, but they reported only what they could find out from others. They were not involved. They knew only what they were told. The most contrived account is contained in John Ehrlichman's recent novel, The Company. He has his JFK, unquote, president, deciding to ensure the failure of the operation while at the same time not calling it off. There are other accounts of this crucial event. One of these, which appears to be authentic because of the inner sanctum role of the author, is Arthur Schlesinger's 1,000 Days. Schlesinger recalls, at 4:30 a.m. invasion morning, Cabell awoke Rusk, and later appealed to President Kennedy to permit the vital B-26 mission to go. There is no evidence Cabell called JFK even then, nor was there any reason to call at that time. This was a clever ruse, Prouty goes on to say here. This was a clever ruse. Remember, I was called at about 2 a.m. At 2 a.m. or even 3 a.m., there was still time for the B-26s to fly from Nicaragua to Santiago and hit their targets by daybreak. By 4:30 a.m., it was much too late. To be effective, the B-26s had to hit those T-33s on the ground no later than daybreak. I would interrupt here, but it would have taken a long time for the B-26s to fly across the Caribbean to Santiago, Cuba. Continuing here, as Prouty writes, to be effective, the B-26s had to hit those T-33s on the ground no later than daybreak. This was crucial. The brigade was set to hit the beach at dawn. They knew that even before they hit the beach, they could be discovered. They were. At dawn, the alarm was flashed across Cuba, and the T-33s went into action. When Cabell withheld the release orders from his mission commander in Nicaragua, he doomed the whole operation to failure. This means that a purported 4:30 a.m. call from Cabell to Rusk, unquote, as reported by Schlesinger, was meaningless except in the event Cabell wanted Rusk, Bundy, and Schlesinger to believe he was trying to carry out the operation instead of thwarting it. Schlesinger's account proves this. He says, Castro's Air Force, alerted by the first clash, reacted with vigor. Unquote. The only combat Air Force Castro had that morning were those three T-33s. Then Schlesinger adds, Castro's forgotten, my emphasis, T-33s shot four B-26s down. Schlesinger's use of the word forgotten is strange. What in hell does he think all of us were doing that long night? Those T-33s were on everyone's mind. Cabell didn't forget them. We all screamed to him for action against them. He simply let the moment pass, and the whole operation went down the drain. None of us have forgotten that. After the call I received from Nicaragua, I spoke to the CIA command center. I told them about my call. I emphasized the urgency of action as planned. I was not in the CIA line of command and could do no more than pass on the word from Nicaragua. I had worked with most of those clandestine operators since 1955 and knew them well. I knew how dedicated they were and that they, too, wanted the release from Cabell. They believed he must have had some political or other important reason for holding back, but they assured me they would do everything possible to expedite the orders to the commander at Puerto Cabezas. The release never came. We'll never know exactly why. Cabell was a lifelong military officer with a splendid record. Cabell obeyed orders, but in this case, whose orders? He belonged to the ultra-Cold War sect, and he was more a Nixon enthusiast than a Kennedy man. Not much later, JFK fired Cabell. Kennedy may have learned what he needed to know. If you don't agree with this account, then consider what followed. The other air crews thought the Puerto Cabezas bombers had carried out their orders, so they went ahead with their part of the tactical plan. They flew to the beach and began to provide air support. At least 16 of these planes were shot down by the T-33 jets, and at least 32 crewmen died, many of them Americans. That morning, those three T-33s sank both invasion supply ships. That ended the nearby offshore supply support. During the next 2 days, those jets raked the beach and covered Castro's troops as they advanced on the brigade which had dug in just above the high tide line. The invasion failed totally. President Kennedy accepted the blame and later fired Allen Dulles. Prouty goes on to describe how Kennedy put together a team of his most trusted advisors in order to look into the failure of the Bay of Pigs operation, and that basically, following that, as mentioned above, he fired Allen Dulles, but that basically he then went on to attempt to bring covert operations from the control of the CIA back under his own control and that of the Pentagon. Prouty describes that, saying, "Each evening, Bobby would meet with Jack Kennedy and the Irish Inner Circle, O'Donnell, Sorensen, O'Brien, and others. Each evening, they would go over every word spoken in the inquiry." That is, the inquiry into the Bay of Pigs. They looked for clues to the CIA's behavior. They tried to answer the questions, why had the CIA destroyed its own operation? What did the CIA gain in the defeat of the Cubans and in the degradation of the Kennedy administration? Day after day, the lesson became clear. The CIA had signaled Kennedy that his political fate was under CIA control, just as was Eisenhower's in the U-2 incident. Why didn't Cabell call Allen Dulles? There's no evidence that he ever did, and I recall in the anger and disappointment of the CIA operators after the disaster that I never heard anyone bring Dulles' name into the picture. Until some other explanation is found, there is no way to exonerate Cabell. As I mentioned a minute ago, Kennedy went on to clarify the CIA's role vis-a-vis covert operations and to emphasize that he wanted the final word, so to speak, for covert operations to be under his control with direct advice from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Prouty describes this, saying, "The committee learned all of this and more. It met daily well into May of 1961, and then it issued no written report. No report was necessary. JFK found out all he needed to know. Early in June of 1961, he signed some very important presidential directives known as National Security Action Memoranda 55, 56, and 57. These papers are the basis of the story told by Senator Mansfield, among others, that JFK said he would tear the CIA into 1,000 pieces. NSAM 55 was a most unusual directive. It was directed specifically to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Lyman L. Lemnitzer, and it was signed personally by Kennedy. Ordinarily, the president would address the chairman directly only in time of actual war. Kennedy viewed that paper as a declaration that, quote, peacetime operations, unquote, a euphemism for clandestine activities in time of peace, were as important to him as actual wartime operations, and that he wanted the chairman to be his advisor in such instances. Kennedy planned to establish control over the CIA during the remainder of his first term in office. He confided to many that he would complete that Herculean task during his second term. He never achieved that. He was not able to restrain the growth of the war in Vietnam. He was not able to keep the lid on the growth of the CIA-inspired special forces. He was not alive by the end of his first term in office. It's interesting to note that the Church Committee, the Senate committee created to investigate the CIA, has published in Volume 4 of its findings what purports to be a history of the CIA. This official, unquote, history unaccountably misquotes the law which created the agency and misstates the duties and responsibilities of the CIA. Then it proceeds to list chronologically all of the National Security Council top-level directives which outline the CIA's role in covert activities. Although the chronology is almost complete, this important historical document ignores and omits Kennedy's directives NSAM 55, 56, and 57. Such a glaring oversight does more to highlight the behind-the-scenes power and adroitness of the CIA than anything else. This is what presidents have had to fight. It is what President Carter is tangled up in today.
Right, that was the section from Hard Rain, and once again, Dave was reading from an article by L. Fletcher Prouty, who was Air Force focal point officer, specifically involved in the Bay of Pigs, as the focal point officer between the Air Force and any need the CIA might have had for Air Force and military air cover or air support or any military air participation in any CIA operation. So a man in the know and a man in the middle of the Bay of Pigs. What some people think, myself included, was probably the watershed moment for relations between then newly elected President John F. Kennedy and the CIA.
Recall, very briefly, summing up what we looked at. First of all, Kennedy as a candidate had already penetrated this insider's cabal, which, against President Eisenhower's wishes and without his knowledge, was going ahead and planning this operation against Cuba. We then saw how the operation was undertaken and the proposed airstrike to neutralize Castro's Air Force, the order, the go order, so to speak, for that strike was withheld by General Charles P. Cabell. And we saw how this was responsible for the failure of the Bay of Pigs operation, that Kennedy had gone along with what he was supposed to do. In other words, apparently, according to Prouty's account, and bear in mind that Prouty was in the chain of communication, he was a liaison officer and a key one between the Pentagon and CIA, that apparently Kennedy fulfilled his part, his intended role in the mission, that it was General Charles P. Cabell who deep-sixed the Bay of Pigs operation, and as he indicated that later, even the Church Committee was influenced by the CIA to misrepresent not only Kennedy's actions vis-a-vis CIA and covert operations, but the very role of the CIA itself.
Okay, let's go back and look at a couple of other points, too, that are very important here. Now, again, Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher Prouty is making the point that, as the operation stood, President Kennedy had no role in the assignation of any part to the Air Force or the air support and air cover of the operation. And there was, in fact, nothing that he was supposed to have done. Now, what people have since claimed, especially CIA insiders, have tried to paint the picture that then they turned to John F. Kennedy and asked for air cover. And basically, at that point, if John F. Kennedy had provided air cover, once that the T-33s had been allowed to get off the ground, he would have, in fact, been declaring overt war on Cuba and would have, in fact, been putting U.S. planes instead of planes that could have been passed off as belonging to Cuban anti-Castro activists. He would have been putting U.S. planes into action against Cuban planes, which is an overt act of war, would have, in fact, have dragged the entire country into a war with Cuba, as opposed to the deniability. And now we're not talking about morality, we're talking about the facts of the occasion, as opposed to the deniability of the Bay of Pigs. Also, another key point that has to be reiterated, which is according to all the reliable sources that we have found, most notably Colonel Prouty, who was in on it from the beginning, the entire Bay of Pigs operation was fostered and was nurtured long before John F. Kennedy was even elected. It was spearheaded by Richard Nixon, Alan Dulles, and the rest of the people that Prouty calls the secret team. And then when Kennedy came into office, and mind you, he only came into office in January of 1961, walked into the door of the White House on January 23, 1961, he was presented with a fait accompli, which means an accomplished fact, an accomplished thing. And so that's a crucial thing to keep in mind. Now, we are going to talk briefly about Mr. Cabell, or General Cabell again.
Okay, now keep in mind, before the Nipper presents you with the information about Cabell here, that at the time of that Kennedy assumed the presidency, either the entire U.S. intelligence apparatus, the entire national security apparatus, or a majority interest thereof, had in essence declared its independence of the U.S. Constitution. It had begun to operate on its own, independent of and contradictory and contradicting at times presidential authority. And that Kennedy, with those memoranda, National Security Action Memoranda 55, 6, and 7, was attempting to bring covert operations back to some semblance of constitutionality, namely to reinstitute the president as commander-in-chief of the armed forces as the ultimate arbiter of whether or not a covert operation was to be undertaken or not.
Okay, we are going to be reading now. I'm going to be reading now from a book entitled Coincidence or Conspiracy. It's been produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations under the direction of Bernard Fensterwald, Jr., and also compiled by Michael Ewing. This book is a Zebra Books product published by Kensington Publishing Corporation, New York, 1977, and it's copyrighted by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations. And Mr. Fez Fensterwald has a long history of research into the John F. Kennedy assassination and other political events.
And Mr. Fensterwald, in addition to having been one of the long-standing assassination investigators, was none other than James McCord's defense attorney. James McCord was the security coordinator for the Committee to Re-elect the President for President Nixon in 1972. And James McCord led the so-called plumbers unit that was arrested inside of the Democratic National headquarters at the Watergate Hotel. The whole Watergate-JFK connection we're going to come back to in the future, but it's worth noting just where Fensterwald fits into American political life.
Right, and you can his data, incidentally, that we're going to be citing here is the references have been checked and found quite solid. As to Mr. Fensterwald's position, it is kind of a strange one, and he certainly, if nothing else, has been a Washington insider, as evidenced by his representation of Mr. McCord, and we'll be talking about that in the past. But once again, this documentation has been found other places. We're just choosing this because this is a well-ordered source for what we're talking about. Once again, reading from Coincidence or Conspiracy, produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations.
Now, keep in mind here that the subject of the discussion here, General Charles T. Cabell, is the individual that Prouty has fingered as withholding the go order for the B-26 strike to neutralize Castro's Air Force, thereby sabotaging the entire CIA's Bay of Pigs operation, usually attributed to the failure of which is attributed to Kennedy.
That's right. Okay. And under the subheading of General Charles T. Cabell, I read as follows. Air Force General Charles Cabell served as deputy director of the CIA under Allen Dulles, and as acting director of the CIA during the Bay of Pigs invasion while Dulles was out of the country. According to the Senate Intelligence Committee report in late 1975, as deputy director of the CIA, General Cabell had also been a party to the secret CIA mafia assassination conspiracies against Fidel Castro during the latter part of September of 1960. According to a secret CIA Inspector General's report, noted by the Senate Intelligence Committee, quote, with Bissell present, Edwards briefed the director, Allen Dulles, and the DDCI, that's the deputy director, Cabell, General Charles T. Cabell, on the existence of an assassination plan involving members of the syndicate. And they're referring to an assassination plan against Fidel Castro. Days later, during the week of September 25th, Robert Mayhew, that's spelled M-A-H-E-U, that's a name that crops up quite often in this type of work, the CIA support chief and mafia leaders John Roselli, Sam Giancana, and Santos Traficante met in Miami to set up the secret assassination plans, according to the Senate committee. Again, at this point, they're talking about the assassination of Fidel Castro. General Cabell was later replaced as deputy director of the CIA by President Kennedy in April 1962 due to what Kennedy believed was Cabell's poor performance during the Bay of Pigs invasion and planning. While Kennedy had been greatly angered over what he believed was the astonishingly negligent invasion planning, he had rejected the advice of some aides to dismiss the CIA and military officials on whom he placed the blame. Pierre Salinger recalled the president remarking, quote, we really blew this one. How could that crowd at CIA and the Pentagon be this wrong? Still, as Salinger recalls, Kennedy decided to wait a, quote, decent interval before replacing the top CIA officials. JFK's former press secretary remembers the president stating, quote, if I'm going to knock some heads together, now isn't the time to do it with everybody looking down the barrel at us. While Deputy CIA Director Cabell's role in the secret CIA mafia assassination conspiracies was revealed in late 1975, the general had been the subject of an even more startling allegation about assassinations 2 years earlier. On September 16, 1973, the Washington Post reported, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, as late as March 1971, was preparing to accuse another person of conspiring to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. Garrison's intended defendant this time was the late Air Force General Charles Cabell, former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The Post's reported that only limited details were available about the controversial district attorney's latest conspiracy theory, but noted that General Cabell's brother, Earl Cabell, had been mayor of Dallas at the time of the assassination. The Post reported that Earl Cabell was aware of Garrison's suspicions that he or his brother may have been involved in the assassination, and had said of Garrison, quote, "He's nuttier than a fruitcake." The Washington Post account also stated that Garrison had told a former aide about his suspicions of what he claimed were General Cabell's, quote, "mysterious movements" in New Orleans in November of 1963. Garrison reportedly believed that President Kennedy's decision to remove Cabell as deputy director of the CIA, and replace other CIA officials as well, had played a part in what Garrison claimed was the eventual assassination conspiracy. As far as is known, however, Garrison never pursued these allegations any further. General Charles Cabell died of a heart ailment on May 25, 1971, in a Fort Myers clinic. During his retirement, Cabell served as consultant to Howard Hughes in the Hughes Aircraft Corporation and as a board member of Air America, a CIA proprietary firm. Cabell reportedly worked closely with Robert Mayhew during that period. All right, so once again, just to quickly reiterate the connections there, General Charles T. Cabell, who Fletcher Prouty, a man in a position to have deep inside information on the subject, has fingered, as Dave put it, as the person who scotched the Bay of Pigs operation, who chose not to send in the air support, or the air cover, rather, to destroy Castro's T-33 planes on the ground, thereby destroying the entire invasion and any chance it might have of success, and putting the blame for it squarely in the lap of the president. General Charles T. Cabell, coincidentally enough, turns out that his brother was the mayor of Dallas, who apparently also, Dave, had helped to arrange the route of the motorcade.
He did, and he was in the motorcade himself, as, of course, was then-Texas Governor John Connally, who, as Secretary of the Navy, basically sort of ex post facto downgraded Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge to dishonorable. Remember, he had initially had an honorable discharge after allegedly defecting to the Soviet Union and performing espionage against the United States. Then Secretary of the Navy John Connally, who was governor of Texas, also in the motorcade, and along with Earl Cabell, Dallas mayor, helped arrange the motorcade route. He downgraded Oswald's status to dishonorable. And John Connally later, of course, became Nixon's Secretary of the Treasury.
And, of course, John Connally is going to play a rather key role in some of the discussions that we're going to be having next week when we talk about the magic bullet and the single bullet theory and the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because, of course, John Connally found himself perhaps rather closer to the events than he might have wished to be, and, in fact, closer than anybody might have wished to be.
And it's worth noting here that this coincidence that Cabell, Charles T. Cabell, who Prouty attributes the failure of the Bay of Pigs to, his brother just happened to be the mayor of Dallas and arranging the motorcade route. As we're going to see, there is a remarkable series of coincidences. Indeed, as the title of Fensterwald book implies, is it a coincidence or is it a conspiracy? Can you have such a remarkable series of coincidences and still say with a straight face that they are coincidences? Now, a couple of interesting details that were brought up by Fensterwald in his account of Charles T. Cabell. Perhaps the most significant of those for our purposes right now is the fact that Cabell, as deputy director of the CIA, was one of the individuals involved with recruiting three top mafiosi, Sam Momo Giancana, John Roselli, and Santos Traficante, for attempts against the life of Fidel Castro. Now, Bay of Pigs, recall, has failed. And so now CIA is allegedly trying to get Castro out some other way. Now, recall that it was the CIA or an element thereof that prevented Bay of Pigs from getting rid of Castro, as we've seen. So certainly we have to, I think, at least ask ourselves, you know, what was CIA's motivation in this whole thing? Now, in order to get rid of Castro, the CIA, through Sheffield Edwards and Richard Helms and Charles Cabell, turned to these three top mafiosi to get rid of Castro. Now, it's worth noting that the exact role of Charles Cabell in this CIA mafia plot to kill Castro is very mysterious, because the account of this event was drawn up by Richard Helms in 1967 for President Johnson. He made no mention of exactly what Cabell's role was. Cabell briefed Sheffield Edwards and Richard Helms, who were in charge of... I forgot what their exact... I know Sheffield Edwards was in charge of operations, and I've forgotten exactly what Helms' title was, but they were the two CIA officials who Cabell briefed on what was going on. And Cabell's role remains very mysterious, and This is worth noting because he crops up as an increasingly mysterious and yet central pivotal figure in this series of events.
It's important also to understand that the CIA did not suddenly turn to the mafia with lily white hands and say, maybe we could try these guys. There's a CIA mafia connection that goes back quite a long ways. At the end of the Second World War, the CIA was already pumping money in. I see you waving your finger there.
Yeah, I think in order to really understand the cooperation between U.S. intelligence and the mafia before the key events after the war, which are really touched directly on what we're going to talk about, it might be worth noting that actually during World War II is where we have the beginning of the pattern of cooperation
with FDR and Lucky Luciano.
What really happened was there was massive Axis sabotage on the docks of New York. To counter this, President Roosevelt turned to Lucky Luciano, who was, I believe at that time, capo mafioso for at least New York City, if not the whole syndicate. And, he turned to Meyer Lansky. Luciano was in jail.
Right.
And Meyer Lansky set up a quid pro quo. He offered to enlist the entire syndicate army in order to prevent Axis sabotage on East Coast docks in return for Lucky Luciano's eventual release from prison. And so, as a result, the docks were secured. This pattern, which this project was known as Operation Underworld, and it forged an effective pattern of cooperation between the mob and U.S. intelligence. And Lucky Luciano was eventually released from prison, and the mob secured the docks against Axis sabotage.
That's right. And the important thing, too, then, as this continues on, once the contact had been made, and we're going to be talking about this in a number of areas, how once an intelligence group makes a contact and begins to compromise itself for whatever purpose it feels is useful or worthwhile, it becomes very difficult to back out of these partnerships. We're going to be talking about that at some point as far as the United States Intelligence Network's contact with the Nazi intelligence network. And in fact, this also became the case with the mafia as more and more people in the right-wing intelligence apparatus began to see the mafia as being a tool against leftist activity in Italy, in newly freed Italy immediately at the end of World War II, and began to pump money into the mafia there so that they could literally combat the Italian socialist and communist movements. They also did this in France and with the Corsican gangsters and a variety of other places. So by the time of the Bay of Pigs and the subsequent contacts between the CIA and the mafia, the CIA had contacts with the mafia for so long that there was no possibility of backing out, and one almost gets the feeling that they said to each other, well, as long as we're stuck in this together, why don't we enjoy it? And this pretty much brings us up to the point of the attempted assassinations of Fidel Castro.
Okay, now, it's worth noting that the mob didn't need a whole lot of prodding in order to be disposed to killing Fidel Castro. Now, the mafia had a tremendous interest in Cuba. Meyer Lansky, the aforementioned, the man who formed the syndicate, he's sort of credited with bringing organized crime up to the corporate level. So, Meyer Lansky had initially formed a working relationship with the deposed dictator, the dictator of Cuba that Castro deposed, Fulgencio Batista. Basically, during Prohibition, Lansky went to Cuba and basically worked out Cuba as a source of sugar cane, which, of course, is used for distilling whiskey. And it not only became, Cuba, that is, not only became a key source of sugar cane for the mob distillers and bootleggers, but it also became a tremendous source of narcotics after the re-legalization of the repeal of Prohibition and the legalization of liquor. So Cuba was a prime mafia property. It was one of the main jumping off points for the massive narcotics traffic into the United States that in turn was set up as a sort of a reward to the mob for their anti-communist efforts at the end of World War II. Their narcotics traffic was protected. It was guaranteed. Cuba was a key jumping off point for that. Plus, Cuba was a very, very lucrative gambling center for the mob. The Cuban gambling casino is a sort of legend to this day. And so Cuba was a prime piece of mafia property. They were extremely upset when Castro appropriated it and kicked the mafia out.